warned that the global community must act urgently to prevent a humanitarian disaster. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
South Korea and the U.S. Thursday began large-scale joint military exercises just 25 kilometers south of the fortified border with North Korea. The drills utilize some 600 weapons, including stealth fighter jets, attack helicopters, and South Korea's homegrown K2 tanks. Participants suggest the drills are meant to be a warning.
I think it sends a message generally to the whole world about how strong the alliance is, and that conducting these readiness exercises builds our credibility as an alliance.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has sought to respond assertively to North Korea's missile and nuclear development in lockstep with American forces, which have 28,500 troops in South Korea. For South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, these drills demonstrate peace through strength, the policy of promoting a strong alliance with the United States. Detractors argue that these drills will upset China, provoke North Korea, and generate a regional arms race. North Korea views such drills as a rehearsal for invasion and has previously vowed to respond militarily. And some South Koreans suggest the drills damage the prospects for peace.
When dialogue between the two Koreas progressed, dialogue between the U.S. and North Korea progressed, and large-scale military exercises were suspended, easing tensions and bringing peace. Large-scale military exercises don't enhance the security of South Korea. Rather, they undermine South Korea's security.
Four more rounds of similar large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea live-fire drills are scheduled through mid-June. Frank Smith, Pochon, South Korea.
During the Tel Aviv regime's 11-day offensive in 2021, Israeli warplanes carried out one of the most horrendous massacres in one of the most densely populated neighborhoods in Gaza. The attacks destroyed three residential buildings, killing 44 civilians, including 18 children. Rescue teams took days to pull the bodies from under the rubble. Riyad Shkuntana and his 6-year-old daughter were among the survivors.
When the Israeli warplanes hit the building where we used to live in 2021, we were buried under the destroyed building. I spent 12 hours under the rubble before the rescue team could save me. I could hear the screams of my children calling me from under the debris. But my daughter Susie and I were the only survivors of my family. They told me that my wife and four of my children hadn't been able to make it when they found their bodies.
During the latest Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip, the family suffered again. Israeli jet fighters targeted the apartment adjacent to theirs.
I was playing with my cousins in the other room. Suddenly we heard a massive explosion. I directly rushed to my grandma. I was screaming and crying. The house was filled with smoke. I was frightened that the building might fall on us. We realized that the building next to ours was targeted. We escaped from our apartment, and so did all the other residents.
Susie hasn't been able to speak about the 2021 incident ever since it happened. She becomes speechless anytime she remembers what happened to her and her family back then. Talking to Press TV, her father asserted that there is no safe place in Gaza for his daughter, even though they demanded international protection after the 2021 incident.
It's all lies. Palestinian civilians are never protected from Israeli attacks. We don't trust international protection regulations. She had therapeutic sessions for 2 years, but my daughter is still suffering, and that memory haunts her anytime she hears a loud sound. She deserves to live in peace and security.
Susie Shkuntana is an example of thousands of Palestinian children who suffer from trauma under the Israeli occupation.
According to reports, 90% of Gaza children suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, which indicates the extent of physical and psychological violence they experience under the Israeli occupation. Palestinian children have the right to enjoy a life of peace and safety, rather than a life of horror and insecurity. Al-Asif, Gaza.
The Islamic Center of England, a registered British religious charity in London, temporarily closed months after its Muslim trustees were removed by the UK's aid watchdog, the Charity Commission, over what it called the trustees' failure to comply with their legal duties and responsibilities and their failure to protect the charity's assets. The commission appointed an interim manager to the charity in early May. That interim manager is Emma Moody, a non-Muslim with the law firm Womble Bond Dickinson.
A charity is there to serve a group of people, its supporters, people who use it, and indeed has to address their needs, their aspiration from a religious or within their statutory of the charity. And that has been ignored. I mean, it's been ignored because what we are seeing now, appointing a secular, non-Muslim sort of lawyer all the way in sort of north of England to run and to sort of dictate what should happen in a mosque and in a charity, it really is outrageous.
It all started with a warning from the charity regulator over a vigil held here in 2020 for revered Iranian military commander General Qasem Soleimani, assassinated in a U.S. drone attack in Baghdad, Iraq, in the same year. The man who spoke at the event says no laws were broken.
Sardar Soleimani wasn't prescribed, or the organization he worked for wasn't prescribed, and is still not prescribed. He was sanctioned, financial sanction, for issue of Syria. Now, when somebody dies and you talk about that person, you're not supporting financially the person. He's already dead. You know, there is no issue of breaking the sanction. It's outrageous that a charity commission, an organization we're supposed to support, will actually become so political that actually sort of misinterprets the law.
In the early 2000s, the British government and the Charity Commission initiated a program calling on all UK mosques to become registered charity. And by doing so, critics say, control what those Muslim institutions could or could not say outside of what is lawful.
We reached out to the authorities here, but they declined to comment. We were told unofficially, though, that the real reason behind the temporary closure of the center, done on the advice of the interim manager, was something to do with insurance, which they hope would be resolved and the doors to the center reopened to the public soon. Saeed Purizep, London.
Lebanon has marked the 23rd anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from Israeli occupation. On this year's anniversary, Beirut was seen to a conference on the resistance front's fight against the world arrogance. The meeting, held by the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance, was attended by guests from over 60 countries. The four-day congregation's theme is the resilience of the axis of resistance and its role in breaking the siege, ending sanctions, and overthrowing normalization.
This is more than necessary now to unite the people against this American-Israel aggression, because we have the same problem everywhere. You know this very good from the Middle East. I'm from Serbia. We know it as well from the Balkans. But now they start to attack the other European countries because they only use terrorism, like they kill General Soleimani.
Some participants said the liberation of southern Lebanon in 2000 and other victories for the resistance front in the last few decades are catalysts for a shift to a multipolar world.
Definitely, there's been a huge change in the world. First, because of the strength of the resistance in our region and the defeat of the American troops in Iraq, Afghanistan, in Lebanon, in Syria. This is now infecting the whole world in hope to escape American hegemony. So we see even this shift of multipolarity actually started because of the resistance in our region.
Western guests present in the conference believe there is growing awareness on the need for resistance against arrogant powers.
The awareness itself is shaped by resistance. So the actual victories in Palestine, in Syria, in Cuba, in Venezuela, these are the things that really shape people's consciousness. But we in the gathering here want to reinforce the values that people have a proper understanding of the importance of the centrality of resistance for human liberation.
An attendee said the resistance front is capable of putting an end to the Israeli regime's relentless atrocities against Palestinians.
Israel has become now a fascist regime. Israel has become a barbaric and a racist and a totalitarian regime. That is the only country in the world which has been supported by Western hegemony and also NATO. But their time, it is nearer. And the resistance and the people of the world, through the international solidarity movement, they will find ways to dismantle the Israeli apartheid regime.
The delegations will be taking a tour to villages in southern Lebanon. They will also pay an official visit to Syria to show solidarity with Damascus in the face of U.S. sanctions. Major transformations in recent years have caused more and more people to resonate with the values of resistance. Participants here consist of not only Lebanese and Palestinians, but people from around the world who are against the aggressive policies of Israel and the United States. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A successful first launch operation. Iran has test-fired its most advanced ballistic missile. The fourth-generation Khorramshahr-class long-range ballistic missile dubbed Khaybar is a liquid-fueled precision-guided missile that can carry a 1,500-kilogram warhead and accurately hit targets 2,000 kilometers farther.
Khorramshahr 4 is the developed version of previous models and is a stealth missile. It can easily bypass enemy air defenses due to its low radar cross-section. It is the result of years of hard work of our engineers at the Aerospace Industries Organization. With its impressive tactical capabilities, the Khorramshahr 4 missile shows that we are fully committed to defending our country.
Khorramshahr 4 has a unique guidance and control system which allows it to adjust its trajectory as it travels through outer space. The system is deactivated as it re-enters the atmosphere. This important feature makes Khorramshahr 4 missiles fully immune to any kind of electronic warfare counterattacks. The newly unveiled missile also has an incredibly short preparation and launch time, and thanks to its liquid-fueled engine, the missile can easily reach hypersonic speeds of Mach 16 in outer space and Mach 8 traveling through the Earth's atmosphere. This makes detecting and tracking the missile impossible, which means it is totally invisible to radars.
When we talk about our defense capabilities, the name Khorramshahr stands for self-reliance and sacrifice, the two qualities that lead to the liberation of the city of Khorramshahr back in 1982. So this type of missile is rightfully named Khorramshahr. And the fourth generation that was unveiled today marks a significant advancement in Iran's ballistic missile technology while enhancing its defense capabilities and deterrence. This is good news for our nation.
All of this is happening on the 41st anniversary of the liberation of the southwestern city of Khorramshahr during the Iran-Iraq War, a major turning point that tipped the scales in Iran's favor, designating the word Khorramshahr as a code name for victory, perseverance, and self-reliance.
And what better way to celebrate the liberation anniversary of the city of Khorramshahr than by unveiling this ballistic missile? Khorramshahr 4 is a precision-guided missile which is considered a symbol of determination and self-sufficiency. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Nakba is not merely a past event. It is an ongoing reality Palestinians live, where every day brings more killings, closures, detentions, home demolitions, racial discrimination, humiliation, and segregation by the Zionist regime. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, "In the Palestinian memory, the month of May will always be associated with the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing of the native Palestinian population from their homes and lands in 1947 to 49 was foundational to the creation of the fabricated regime of Israel. It was only with the forced expulsion of 750,000 to 1 million Palestinians, as well as the killing of thousands of others, many in tens of masses across Palestine, that the emerging Zionist regime could secure a Jewish majority. But clearly, the colonial regime is not yet feeling either satisfied or safe. On the contrary, this month, May 2023, 75 years after the Nakba, Palestine has endured a series of new Israeli regime assaults. On May 2nd, the Palestinian prisoner Khaz Adnan died in an Israeli regime jail after nearly 3 months of hunger strike. He embarked on hunger strike in protest at his administrative detention. Detention without charge or trial. Adnan spent 8 years on and off in Israeli regime prison, mostly in administrative detention. His death could not have been an accident. The Zionist regime was aware that he needed urgent health care, yet none was proffered and was not transferred to hospital. He was allowed to die on purpose in order to deter other prisoners from engaging in similar hunger strikes. His death triggered a major Israeli regime assault, which started on May 9th, when Israeli regime warplanes struck a number of residential buildings in Gaza where families were sleeping. The first strikes killed 12 and injured 20. Among the victims were three Islamic Jihad fighters, along with their wives and children. That first assault was followed by several others over 5 days. At least 33 Palestinians were killed, the majority civilians, including 7 children. The fabricated regime of Israel has killed some 140 Palestinians in both the West Bank and Gaza since the beginning of 2023. Since the 1948 Nakba, the Zionist regime has killed over 100,000 Palestinians and destroyed at least 130,000 homes and other structures. Since the occupation of the rest of historic Palestine in 1967, the Zionist regime has imprisoned more than 1 million Palestinians, while still depriving Palestinian refugees from returning to their homes and villages. And in recent years, May has become the killing month. In 2021, an Israeli regime assault on Al-Quds Al-Aqsa Mosque led to a broad confrontation with Palestinians across Palestine, resulting in the killing of 256 Palestinians in Gaza, including 66 children and 40 women. Last May, an Israeli sniper killed renowned Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh while she was working in Jenin. A few days later, Israeli regime police attacked her funeral in Al-Quds. Such wanton violence suggests that the Zionist regime's ethnic cleansing project has not finished. A regime based on aggression and the systematic terrorizing of Palestine's native population will not rest easy until the project started in 1948 is complete. But in 75 years, the Zionist regime has not yet succeeded to back up its foundational lie that Palestine was a land with no people. By obliterating the Palestinian people, their memory, their history, or their refusal to give up. In other words, the Zionist regime is fearful and agitated. It lives in constant obsession with being surrounded by danger. In light of such logic, the existence of Palestinians in Palestine alone is incendiary to the colonial regime of Israel. After the latest Israeli regime aggression on Gaza, which saw at least six Islamic Jihad leaders assassinated, the Zionist regime projected arrogance. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Zionist regime's prime minister, declared that Israel's assault had changed the balance of deterrence and proudly announced that Israel's flag march and annual right-wing nationalist assertion of sovereignty over occupied Al-Quds would proceed as planned. Stable and sane countries do not feel the need to prove sovereignty over cities they claim as capitals. It is a symbol of deep-seated malaise that the Zionist regime considers it a glorious victory after 56 years of occupation to organize a march for settlers to wave flags in Al-Quds. The flag march is a victory only in the way the Israeli regime's military ability to kill and detain Palestinians or encage them in checkpoints is a victory. It is made possible only through overwhelming force and the continued support of Western regimes. The hollow victory is not a defeat for Palestinians who continue to struggle and resist to preserve their existence despite the tremendous suffering and military violence they have to confront. The Zionist regime cannot give up its inherently violent colonial nature precisely because it was established by uprooting a people from their homeland. The continued presence of Palestinians on part of their land directly contradicts the Zionist narrative of how the fabricated regime of Israel emerged. The fabricated regime of Israel is still in denial and believes the only way for it to continue to exist is through the ethnic cleansing and cancellation of Palestine's indigenous people. Every new Israeli crime maximizes Palestinian suffering, but it also demonstrates that far from being confident and at ease with itself, the Zionist regime is a regime of fear and insecurity. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported recently the Israeli occupation authorities demolished, confiscated, or forced people to demolish 42 structures in East Al-Quds and Area C of the West Bank, including 17 homes, citing the lack of Israeli-issued building permits, which are almost impossible to obtain, displacing 50 Palestinians, including 23 children, and affecting the livelihoods of more than 600 others, according to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, in the occupied Palestinian territory. It said in its bi-weekly protection of civilians report covering the first 2 weeks of May that 9 of the structures were provided by donors as humanitarian assistance, including a school. More than half of the affected structures were in Area C, which is under full Israeli regime military control, including a donor-funded school. The remaining 16 structures were demolished in occupied East Al-Quds, including two residential structures demolished in Wadi Qaddoum area of Silwan, resulting in the displacement of 7 households comprising 39 people, including 22 children. Another 7 structures were destroyed by their owners to avoid the payment of fines to the Zionist regime authorities. Additionally, in Area A of the West Bank, under full Palestinian rule, Israeli regime forces destroyed 1 residential structure and caused damage to 3 others during an Israeli regime operation carried out in the old city of Nablus. On May 7th, Israeli regime forces demolished an EU-funded Palestinian school serving at least 40 pupils from Jebel al-Deeb near Beit Lahm, citing the lack of an Israeli-issued building permit and structural safety concerns. 57 schools across the West Bank are at risk of demolition, said OCHA. In a separate incident, on May 10th, the Israeli Civil Administration, along with Israeli regime forces, dismantled and confiscated 2 tents that were used as temporary classrooms for the pupils of the school of Jebel al-Deeb. The tents were provided as humanitarian assistance in response to the demolition on May 7th. During the confiscation, confrontations erupted between Palestinian residents and the Zionist regime forces. As a result, 8 Palestinians were injured. School equipment, including chairs and desks, were confiscated by Israeli regime forces. On May 2nd and 3rd, Israeli regime forces raided the villages of Hajja in Qal Qilia Governorate and Haris in Southeast Governorate in Area B of the West Bank, which is under Palestinian administration and the Zionist regime military control, and demolished on punitive grounds 2 multiple-story homes of families. 3 households comprising 14 people, including 8 children, were displaced. 9 others, including 3 children, were otherwise affected. Since the beginning of 2023, 10 homes and 1 agricultural-related structure have been demolished by the Zionist regime forces on punitive grounds, compared with 14 structures in all of 2022 and 3 in 2021. Punitive demolitions are a form of collective punishment and as such are illegal under international law as they target the families of a perpetrator or alleged perpetrator, said OCHA. In addition to the demolitions, the OCHA report said that from the beginning of 2023 until May 15th, the Zionist regime forces killed 108 Palestinians in the West Bank, including East Al-Quds, more than double the death toll of 51 in the same period in 2022, and 12 other Palestinians have been shot and killed by Israeli regime forces while attacking or trying to attack forces in the West Bank.
This one lay. Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. The Sultan of Oman, Haytham bin Tariq Al Said, is in Iran for the first time since becoming the leader of the kingdom in 2020. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi had invited him to Iran during the president's visit to Muscat. Now, the Omani Sultan is leading a high-level delegation for a two-day visit where the two sides will discuss expanding relations. Iran and Iman have a history of good relations, and the two sides would like to see their cooperation expanding even more. We will take a look at the significance of the Sultan of Oman's visit at this time on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program out of London, Masoud Shankar, a political commentator. And out of Belgrade, John Busness, journalist, activist, and political analyst. Thank you both for being with me. Well, Masoud, let's start off with the significance of this visit by the Sultan in your perspective.
Hi, Masoud. This is really a sort of continuation of an extremely good relation, as you mentioned, between Iran and Oman. And reconfirmation of the continuation that good relation by the new Sultan. This is the first time he's coming to Iran and cementing the good relationship between Oman and Iran that goes many, many years. In reality, history of the region has shown that Iran's best relationship in the region has always been Oman. And this has served both the countries and indeed the security and tranquility of the region. So it is significant to see that this is continuing and is being cemented with the new leadership since 2020.
Okay. Well, John, I mean, your thoughts about the importance of this, especially now that the region is experiencing unprecedented levels of rapprochement between various countries.
Well, I think that this is just another step forward from Iran's perspective, and also it's a stabilizing factor in the entire region. So long as Iran can maintain and expand good relations with a growing number of countries in the region, it means that America and its allies cannot pressure Iran to the extent that they used to try to do. This means that there's a greater likelihood of existing and lasting peace, and it's also a greater likelihood of independent economic development for the entire region.
What about that, Master? You heard what John said, that it means that the United States can pressure Iran less. I mean, we're seeing a growing number of countries either expanding their relations with Iran or reigniting their relations with Iran. Let's talk about the significance of this and what's happening currently.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is a number of reasons for this. One is people realizing Iran historically has never invaded any of its neighbors. It's been having a very stabilizing relationship. Even with Iraq after the war, at the time of the Iraq war, Iran did play much better friend and neighbor than all those who were supporting Saddam Hussein for many, many years. So that is historical sort of reality. But also I think there is another reality. People in the region and countries in the region who solely depended on United States are realizing that United States is not a good friend. The United States actually uses and misuses others for its own sort of benefit, short-term benefit or perceived benefit. And greatest example of that is what they did in Afghanistan, what they did in Iraq, what they did elsewhere in the region, and indeed what they're doing in Ukraine right now. Ukraine is almost shattered to pieces because of the short-term political agenda of the United States and expansionist concept for the NATO. So people are actually realizing that if they want security, if they want stability, if they want continuation of their interests and the interests of their nation and their citizens, then they should not be as obedient friend or servant to the United States. And that's why we are seeing countries are actually realizing that the only way that they could ensure the security is bypass the propaganda of colonial United States, and indeed trying to establish regional security and regional prosperity, economically, politically, socially, and they have a lot more in common. And I think that's one of the reasons we are seeing a shift by Saudi Arabia, Emirates, and everybody else, moving away from the United States and trying to be independent because they see no future in being a stooges of the United States. And from Iran's point of view, Iran is holding old allies like Oman on one side and building upon that with the other neighbors, both in the Persian Gulf and also in the north and elsewhere. And I think that is the significant.
Okay, well, what about that, John? I mean, what Masoud said is more and more of these countries are becoming aware that the United States isn't a good friend. I mean, how do you assess a country like Oman? Because, of course, Oman has close ties, historically has close ties with Iran. It also is close to Washington. So how is it able to actually balance those two sides and the importance of this?
Well, there are basically two options that are on the table. A, Oman is attempting to be a more independent country and therefore broadening its contacts in the region to balance the influence of the United States, or, which is commonly the case with American allies, America has permitted Oman to have contact with Iran because America itself realizes that it needs more contact with Iran to get itself out of the mess that it has created in the region for itself. Either option is bad for America's hegemony, and we have to remember that it's been said repeatedly that there is nothing more dangerous than being an enemy of America than to be a friend of America.
Yeah, it's a very well-known quote these days. It's definitely going around a lot. Well, Masoud, Oman has played over the years the role of mediator between Iran and various Western and Muslim countries. What about this particular visit? Do you think that there is any special meaning behind this visit at the time when the situation in the region is changing so rapidly?
There is. I mean, as I said, this current leader hasn't been to Iran before, so it is significant that he is coming. And the fact of the matter is that there is the change of the mood in the region. I mean, it's not there was a time that Oman was one of the very few countries in a relationship with Iran, and it was always said that that relationship is being encouraged by United States for having a contact, but we're seeing that is not the case now. There is a much, much better relationship with Saudi Arabia, with the Emirates, with Qatar, and the whole region. And the reality is that those countries, including Saudi Arabia, are refusing to be obedient servants of United States when it comes to the price of oil, when it comes to relationship with Russia. And so it really, the significance of this is much, much greater, much wider than just between Iran and the region. And the fact of the matter is that to build upon the relation, good relationship of Oman, and then extend it, which is what the policy has been by this present government of Mr. Raisi, it really sort of shows Iran is going into a different league, and the times are changing tremendously.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, the times are changing tremendously. Let's talk about those times, John, because as Masoud's saying, we are seeing a lot of changes that are taking place in the region. A lot of, as I said earlier, rapprochement or attempts at that. One of these is actually Oman is in the middle of trying to initiate or rekindle the relationship between Cairo and Tehran. And just a couple of days prior to coming to Iran, the Sultan of Oman was in Egypt. Your take on that side of things and the importance, if you believe that it is important, of close relations or rekindling relations between these two countries.
Absolutely. And I'd like to agree completely with the comments of your other commentator today that, yes, this is bigger than just Oman. This is actually a global shift as the world moves towards multipolarity, as everybody recognizes that the so-called sole superpower, America, is not the sole superpower, and as the petroleum producing nations themselves gather around the resource that they have and realize that there are other buyers who do not ask to have sovereignty over your country for dealing with you in business. Now, as this expands to Egypt, and with the role of Oman in Egypt and Iran, we're seeing it move beyond just the countries which are the main oil producers, but to the other Islamic countries in the region. And this means that we've moved beyond the strict economic basis to an actual cultural and political expansion of multipolarity. And I have to say that not many people expected Iran to be able to do this, and this is a feather in the cap of Iran.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about that, Masoud, because from a strategic perspective, when we look at what is happening, again, in the region, and they strengthen the ties with each other. One would think that the country, for example, the United States and its allies that believe in dividing and separating and causing problems, would not be happy about this and likely targeting regional countries to try to change their perspective. Let's talk about that and the possibilities. On the one hand, if these countries have this solidarity, and also the possible problems, the way the United States may target them. How do you see it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is really one of the dangers. The fact is that the United States is in a process of losing his authority and his power. And superpowers, when they're doing that, they're actually the most dangerous. They see it. They see it happening every day. And Egypt is actually a great example of that. I mean, I remember at the time of Islamic Awakening, I went to Egypt four times, and I couldn't even make a phone call from Egypt to Iran. I had to go through a third country, you know, to get connected.
No.
Because it was absurd. And this was the power of the United States trying to divide and rule. And they're extremely, I mean, all the reports indicate that the United States and Israel are fuming over this sort of attempt for the Egypt and Iran to get closer. And this is going to happen elsewhere. So this is in some ways, is very exciting time. And in the same time, is a dangerous time, because the United States is going to use all sorts of tricks to create conflict. And many indicating the sort of the situation of Afghanistan right now is something that behind the scene, it's that divide and rule sort of element coming or trying to show its ugly head. So there has to be very careful, vigilant at the time like this for these countries to move forward positively, becoming closer to each other. But it's going to happen. It's going to happen, and it's continuing to happen. And these hiccups, if they even manage to organize it, are going to be nothing but hiccups. And I see nothing is going to stop this change of mood. And as the other contributor said, it's not just in the region, but it's globally. And it's happening. And it's very exciting.
Right. Yeah. Not just in the region, but globally. Now, John, what would you say? I mean, because this has been happening over the years, various situations that countries have seen, the hegemon in various wars. But what would you say was the main force behind this change right now? Many would say the situation with Russia and Ukraine, and then the way that the United States and its allies basically had frozen Russia funds, and then more and more countries start thinking, well, it could be us too tomorrow, anytime Washington disagrees. I mean, do you see that as the main force behind all this, or your overall assessment?
Well, I would say that could be called the final chapter of the development that's been taking place. But we've got two other elements that actually must have weighed in very heavily on this. We have to recall that there used to be a country or united state called the United Arab Republic, which united Syria and Egypt together as allies and as one functioning state. So it would imply that the growing influence and the great aid that Iran has given to Syria in resisting the ISIS operation run by the United States, the proxy war in Syria, and the effort to topple the leadership of Syria has also opened the door to Syria-Egypt rapprochement. And that's probably taking place under the covers here. And at the same time, Egypt knows the writing is on the wall because of what happened in Libya. So Egypt is seeing itself in a situation where it's looking at its own historic past, its own historic past alliances, and realizing that actually, out of all of this, the one country that has stood still and defended itself and survived all of this is only Iran. So Iran is now building a linkage that ties together Arab nations, that ties together the experience of Libya, and ties together the regional interests of all of the countries around this permanent war zone, which is what America has created with its support for Israel. This is a very, very important strategic step that has at least three factors: Syria, Libya, and Israel all being dealt with and these problems being resolved by Iran's initiative. It is a historic moment indeed.
What about that, Masoud? I mean, at the bottom line, is it that Iran in this 44 years with all of the problems and sanctions and attempted coups and anything we can just about say that existed has been thrown at Iran over the last four decades. And despite this, standing strong, continuing to strengthen, do you think that the regional countries finally got it? Because in the beginning, there was a lot of trying to divide. Of course, this isn't the old English rule of divide and conquer, whether it's between ethnicities, nationalities, religion, whatever. have we matured in the region enough to get over minor differences, concentrate on what we have in common, and help to improve each country in the region by being strong and by being united? Do you think that we're there yet, Masoud, or how do you see it?
We are in that process. I mean, we talked about how the United States cannot be trusted. You know, you look at Libya, you could look at you know, what they did in Afghanistan, and it goes on and on and on, and Ukraine and so forth. And exact opposite is actually the position of Iran's friendship, be it with Syria or be it in Lebanon or be it anywhere else, in Iraq, etc., etc. It's been a friendship, it's been a support, which has been unconditional, and it has been total. Especially, you know, for groups like Palestinians. I mean, the fact of the matter is not based on sort of fakie thing of being supporting Shias or Sunnis and so forth. People have been supported because they needed the support. That has been exactly in contrast what United States has done. But I think also we need to recognize what happened in Qatar at the World Cup. I mean, there was an awakening. I mean, Palestine and Palestinian cause was the real winner. All these nations, they realized, despite all their sort of spend, despite normalization on the level of the governments and ministers and emirs and so forth, ordinary people right across the region are supporting Palestine even more than what they have done or what they was taught. And I think that was also a wake-up call for these governments in the region, that they can't really go against that sort of popularity for a cause within their own population and try to depend on Israeli support or U.S. support and so forth. So there is a combination of everything that is bringing that level of awareness that indeed, if they've got even any sort of intellect, they should see that their future and the future of their country and indeed their leadership depends on this shift that has to take place.
And John, we just have less than a minute actually left right now, about 30 seconds. How do you see it with the situation that Masoud had just talked about? Are you optimistic about the West Asian region, the future? How do you see it?
I am very optimistic. You know, I'm a believing Christian. And if you look back 20 or 30 years ago, there would be very few believing Christians who would be supporting unity among Arabs, among Muslims, and so on. But there are so many of us who have opened our eyes, who have seen that this is a perpetual war by a godless America. They don't believe in God. They believe in their warfare and